you've got the love I need to see me through. Sometimes it seems the going is just too rough, and things go wrong no matter what I do. Now and then it seems like life is just too much, but you've got the love I need to see me through. When food is gone, you are my daily need. Oh, when friends are gone, I know my savior's love is real. You know it's real. You got the love. 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 Time after time, I think, oh Lord, what's the use? Time after time, I think it's just no good. 'Cause sooner or later in life, the things you love, you lose. But you've got the love I need to see me through.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna in beautiful and a little bit foggy but sunny Laguna Beach. I'm your host, Kim Sage, and I am a therapist working in private practice in Newport Beach and currently completing my doctorate in clinical psychology. I work with individuals and couples and teens and children and sometimes families. So today, since Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and sort of regardless of whether you believe Valentine's Day is a commercialized holiday or even a holiday you just really look forward to every year, it's true that it seems like the day comes with a lot of mixed feelings around what our lives should look like, what we hope they're going to look like, and it brings up a lot of people's feelings and thoughts about love and what it means to be in love, to be loved, and really to give love. So I thought today would be a great day. It's one of my first completely solo days on the radio to just really talk about some workshops I've been doing based on these concepts. That's actually where the show idea Loved came from. They are therapy groups and workshops I've run based on all kinds of issues around love, from vulnerability to shame to opening your heart and mind to new people, just whatever's coming up for you. But I've been doing these workshops really based initially on a concept called attachment. And that is really what we're going to talk about today. So I'm going to share it. It's really the basis for understanding, I believe, ourselves in relationships, in love. And those relationships include those with ourself, those with others, and those in our world. And so, like I said, today, you know, the show really came out of that idea. I just ran a group over the weekend, and I thought, you know, this is just such a great topic. So we're going to explore some different concepts around the idea of attachment. As a therapist, the material I do discuss today is really sort of the foundation for me. Once we meet and we start working together, I really do want to understand what your attachment relationships are, and I'm going to explain that really thoroughly for you here in a minute. really found the foundation of attachment is really the meaning. The meaning is really an exploration of what were our lives like when we were first born, even actually in utero. You know, what were those first years like, and then the ongoing years combined with our genetics and our environment and just the different people that come in and out of our lives. Primary caregivers, which actually refers to your sort of parents or grandparents or siblings, whoever was really responsible for taking care of you in those, you know, early several years of your life. That's the ground we're going to cover today. But don't forget that attachment experiences can occur and do occur throughout our lifespan. Because the truth is, all of those experiences really do shape and impact who we love and how we love. So today we're just going to look at the adult perspective of attachment and love. There are many different ways of exploring attachment, but we're going to use it as a basis to understand romantic love in terms of why you fall in love with the people you fall in love with, why you stay maybe when you shouldn't, and why you don't leave maybe when you should, or, you know, why those relationships with who you choose are with people that you're more likely to succeed or not necessarily, I don't want to say fail, but honestly, for the relationships not to work out, which can be heartbreaking. And this concept has been overwhelmingly embraced by people, the idea of attachment, I think because most of us really do want to know and understand, you know, why do I choose the people I choose? Especially if you find yourself in a pattern of choosing people over and over again. And you know, at the core, a lot of the same issues keep coming up. Or just to understand why you've chosen people and why you've stayed or why you've struggled so much. And even why you may have difficulty leaving relationships that deep in your heart, you know, they're just not going to meet your needs down the road. So I'm going to just go through the workshops and I'm going to throw in some music here and there so it's not just me talking the whole time. But really, a lot of these ideas are based on a book called Attached by Amir Levine. It's A-M-I-R, Levine, L-E-V-I-N-E. And I'm also going to throw in some stuff just from working as a therapist. But really, the idea is that people come into therapy and bring issues with relationships. Like I said, whether it's with yourself or someone else, today we're going to talk about romantic love, like I said. And so people come in, or I hear this just out in the world, and I know it to be true. They'll say things like, you know, it's only been a couple weeks in the relationship, and I'm already obsessing about it. I'm sort of trying to decipher every emoji on my text. And this is that thing where, you know, it's like, are there two smiley faces or three? Was there an exclamation point? I mean, it's come to that. We can get super into trying to interpret everything. And we could do a whole show on texting and that impact on relationships, and maybe I will. But that's an example. People will say things like, God, what's wrong with me? You know, I meet someone and I'm really into them and then I lose interest and I start to feel trapped. Why is it so hard? Or they might say something like, you know, I'm in a relationship, but honestly, I feel completely alone. And I think being in a relationship, in fact, I know from personal experience as well, that it can be lonelier with someone than actually being alone. And then people will come in and say things like, you know, this person, so-and-so, is such a great guy or a great woman. Why is she with that jerk? Or why is he with that woman who doesn't treat him well? Or whatever words you want to, or adjectives you want to throw in there. And so we know that the idea of love brings us together, but then it becomes a question of, you know, is love enough? And unfortunately, most of us past, I think, you know, sixth grade will tell you that love alone is just, it's just not enough. So where does that leave us? That really brings us to the idea of attachment. What is attachment and where did it come from? So if you think about it, from the time we are in utero, we are literally physically attached, you know, by the umbilical cord. And if we don't have that, we don't survive. So the idea is that from the beginning, we are attached and we need that to thrive. And therefore, we have a sort of evolutionary ties to attachment and to bonding to people. that over time, selection favored people who were able to attach. You know, if you think about it, if you don't have someone to take care of you as a newborn human child, you're not going to survive. And so we are genetically programmed to have these bonds. And then, of course, there's all kinds of physical reinforcements, oxytocin and all kinds of things like that, that really reinforce those bonds. And we need them. And so over time, these bonds get passed on generationally. People who learn how to attach and are able to attach are more likely to survive. And we really call that in the sort of psychological community, that's our attachment system. It's really this internal working model of our emotions and our behaviors in terms of how we relate to other people. So I thought that I'd give you a quick break here, and then we'll come back and we're going to talk about what really was the foundation of understanding attachment and some amazing research called The Strange Situation. So you can begin to understand that more. And I just hope you'll come back and join me. You're listening to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna.
When the dark clouds come your way, when your demons can't be tamed, when your last straw's about to break, and you feel your heart can't take anymore, when your second chance is gone, when you're barely hanging on, when you're tired of being strong and you don't know where to run anymore, I wanna take a but I just don't have the words. Let me hold you. Let me hold you tight. Let me hold you. Just let me hold. When the shadow's always there, when you can't come up for air, when tomorrow seems to lead nowhere, and there's no answer to your prayer anymore, I wanna take your but I just don't have the words. Let me hold you. Let me hold you tight. Let me hold you. Just let me hold you. Thank you. know you, but I want you all the more for that. And words fall through me and always fool me, and I can't react. And games that never amount to more than they're meant will play themselves out. Take this sinking boat and point it home. We've still got time. Raise your hopeful voice. You have a choice. You've made it now. Falling slowly, eyes that know me, and I can't go back. And moods that take me and erase me, and I'm painted black. Well, you have suffered enough and warred with yourself. It's time that you won. Take this sinking boat and point it home. We've still got time. Raise your hopeful voice. You have a choice.
And welcome back to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna in Laguna Beach. Today we're talking about adult attachment, really adult love, and why we love the way we do and who we love the way we do. And before the break, we were just going through sort of the idea of where attachment comes from, that it has biological ties to our childhood and the fact that we have to attach literally and metaphorically and emotionally to survive. And so really, there's been a lot of work in attachment, but one of the premier studies and understandings of how we view attachment came from an experiment called the Strange Situation that Mary Ainsworth did in the early 70s. And there are a lot of facets to the study, and I'm not going to bore you and go through the whole thing, although actually it's not boring to me. It is fascinating, but I'm going to sort of condense it for you. So there were about 100 families that were studied, and what happened were was that there's some researchers that went in, and when babies were first born over the first course of their first year, they were observed. The relationship and the caregiving relationship was observed between mom and baby. So we know that lots of people provide caregiving. In this study, we're just talking about moms. So just keep that in mind. So basically, they observed the interaction and the quality of the caregiving. You know, did mom meet baby's needs? Did mom understand the different types of cries? Those types of things. And then when the infants were between 12 months and 18 months, they brought them into an experiment room that was filled with toys. It was a room that neither baby nor mom had ever been in before. And there are about 8 different phases to the whole thing. But basically what happened was mom and baby come in alone quickly. And then at some point, a researcher comes in. And then at some point, the researcher stays and mom just sort of quietly gets up and leaves. And then she comes back. And so what's being observed is, you know, the baby's behavior from the beginning of the experiment through the end. And what they found were really some really interesting and unique and different behaviors, but also somewhat predictable based on the types of caregiving that they understood these children to have experienced. So there are technically more than 3. There's another 4th and some other parts. We're going to discuss 3 because they really tie into the idea of adult attachment. So for the babies that were deemed to be what we're going to call secure. So there's secure, anxious, and avoidant. I'm just going to make them simple like that. The babies that were secure, what happened was when mom left, they became upset. And, you know, normally sort of so. But then when she returned, they were fairly easily reassured. And at some point, they were able to go back and continue to play and explore the room. For those who were deemed anxious, what happens here is that the baby gets really upset when mom leaves. But when she returns, the child acts what we call ambivalently. So she's sort of angry, or he is angry and happy at the same time. Sort of like, you know, this push-pull going on that I'm happy to see you, but I'm mad at you for leaving. And that really happens. And then what happens is the babies never really are fully explorative of the room and never go back to the level that they were. And at times, even their ability to remain calm after being upset was temporary. And then for the babies who were deemed avoidant, what happens here is that this is, to me, is the most fascinating. When mom leaves the room, the babies would, many of them, turn around and follow her with their eyes. So they're watching her and they know she's leaving, but they're not really reacting. There's not a lot going on externally for them. They don't seem really upset and they don't do as much exploring, but also when she comes back, there's not a lot of response from them. But what is so incredibly fascinating is that when their heart rates were measured and the stress hormones in their body were measured, they were just as upset as those babies who were really crying and really, you know, crying and being upset and having a hard time. So what's fascinating is that at 12 to 18 months, these are children who had already learned, you know what, I'm not going to get my needs met or, you know, some combination of it not being safe or predictable. And so I don't even need to register what's going on with me. It's not going to make a difference if I do. So when you think about that experience and how that might play out in your adult life, you know, it's pretty profound. And so because of these styles, we know that people who have, or who, you know, generally speaking, and these styles can be fluid, people can often be mixed, and that's definitely something I'll address later in the show. But generally speaking, babies who are secure tend to be adults who grow up feeling comfortable with intimacy, and they're more warm and loving. So in these scenarios, mom was more available, able to meet their needs, and somewhat consistent and predictable in terms of that capacity. For people who, as adults, are more anxious, these are often people who crave intimacy. They're often preoccupied about their relationships. They tend to worry about their partner's ability to love them back. And if you're already a person with anxiety, you can imagine what this does to you in a relationship. And we know that these were the moms who were not as consistent. They were not predictable. Sometimes they were available and sometimes they weren't. Sometimes it was because they were physically gone. Sometimes because they were often preoccupied with their own emotions. So you can imagine sort of the world that creates for you as an infant if that's your experience. And then those who are more what we call avoidant in terms of adult attachment, these are people who really equate intimacy with a loss of independence on some level. And so they're always constantly trying to minimize closeness. And they do this often through sending mixed signals. Now you have to think about it. You know, nobody who's completely avoidant is going to be out in the world saying I'm avoidant, and then who'd want to be in a relationship with them? These are people who at some level want to be, but they're so sort of overwhelmed with the idea of truly being intimate and close that they find ways to sort of, get out of the relationship. If you take a step forward, they're probably going to take a step back. And it can be very, very subtle and honestly very confusing, especially in the beginning of a relationship, because in the beginning, they're putting their best foot forward. And we may not see these signals until later in the relationship. So we're going to talk more about that too. So the ideas that are basic to attachment really are the ideas that we monitor and maintain emotional and physical closeness with our beloved for a reason. That we reach out to this person when we are unsure, upset, or even feeling down. And we miss them when they're gone from us. And so, you know, these attachment needs are being triggered. And that's what's happening. And that really, in the greatest circumstance, that we should be able to count on this person to be there for us when we go out into the world and explore. And really, the idea of adult attachment says that the theory is that our loved one is really our shelter in life. So I think that's a great vision, having a loved one be your shelter. The other concept that I think is so amazing, there's an amazing quote by Stan Tatkin, who has a lot of other great pieces of work regarding the brain and love and attachment. But here's the quote. I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to sort of go back and break it down based on what we've already talked about. So it says, "The partner we unconsciously choose is dauntingly similar, warts and all, especially the warts, to caretakers who reared us. Thus, the needs we want met in our adult intimate relationships, those that were not met in our childhoods, are presented to persons," meaning those people we date, "who are woefully similar to the persons," meaning our parents or caregivers, "who didn't meet these needs when we were children." So if you think about it, you're going out into the world, you know, you're like, okay, this time I'm going to get those needs met. This is all, of course, an unconscious thing for most people. But because of our magnetized draw to people who we feel familiar with, like our parents or caregivers, we're often being drawn to people who are actually going to give us or not give us exactly what we wanted or didn't get and needed as a child. So that explains that whole concept of, gosh, why do I keep choosing the same partners over and over again? You know, they seem different on the outside, but at the end of the day, it's often very similar. And all of that really puts sort of the myth of codependency, which I know you probably hear this word all the time. And with regard to addiction, this theory argues that it's totally, totally relevant and important. But the idea of attachment is really contrary to the myth of codependency, because we know that, you know, when you have a relationship, you have a me, a you, and a we. And historically, there have been a lot of marriage counseling failures around this idea, because what happened was people came into therapy and, you know, they were like, okay, I'm going to do me and you're going to do you. And there was a bias around me, but no one addressed the we. And we know that that has led, when people do that, it leads to a lot of divorce, no question, because you're not addressing the we. So it's important that we reframe those ideas and understand that, of course, you shouldn't sacrifice all of yourself for anyone. You need to maintain your own healthy boundaries and be yourself, but you have to address the we-ness of the relationship. And sometimes one person is trying to do that, but the other person won't. And that's often where we see a lot of conflict. or both of them are trying to just do me. And so, you know, but like I said before, this is an evolutionary thing. We have to do this to survive. So it makes sense that we want it. We all know in today's world, it's hard to do, no question. And because of this, the brain is really truly wired to seek support and form a physiological unit. I talked about this in my workshop that there's been all kinds of studies that support this. So, you know, back to the studies during World War II with orphans, we know that if they're just given their basic needs, but not given love or attachment or touching, that these children died. We need more than just our basic needs met. There have been studies regarding children in hospitals. You know, it used to be that if your child was sick, you went up to the hospital and dropped them off, and you maybe got a visiting hour, even though you were the parent. And over time, research revealed that children who had a loving figure being held in the NICU, you know, all of those types of things that really increase attachment bonds helped increase their chance for survival. So that's another example. And then there was a study done, and I'm not going to go into it either, but basically women were given shocks. And the way it worked was the initial shock was given not holding anyone's hand, sort of being alone. And they registered their blood pressure and hormone levels and heart rate and breathing. And, you know, it was pretty high without anyone near you that you cared about. When they allowed the women to hold someone's hand, not their caregiver or lover's hand, but just someone's hand, these physiological responses, they went down some, you know, just having someone's hand to hold helped. When they were able to hold the hand of their partners, and if they said that they were especially bonded to or had a good relationship with their partner, the blood rates and all these heart rates things, they barely registered, which is just crazy. So it just shows you that if you have that love and support, it truly impacts how you go out into the world. And so all of that really does put, you know, make dependency sort of a paradox. And what that really means is that actually you're more likely to go out into the world if you have someone who you can count on, someone who has your back. That's the core of attachment and the idea of a secure base. Remember, the babies who had the secure base, after they were sort of, you know, tended to by mom being upset, they went back and explored their environment and weren't afraid to continue on. And the other two never ever explored it as much and never even returned to the same level of exploring for the most part. So the idea is that regardless of, you know, how independent you are, that on some level inside you have this need to have some dependency, and that vulnerability and the fear of loss, of losing the person you love, it's always inside you. It's just you're dealing with it and it's playing out in your relationship differently depending upon sort of the way you view caregiving and the way you've internalized what that looks like. So we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Loved with Kim Sage on KX1 Laguna. And we come back, we're going to talk about what's called protest behaviors, which is really a way to find out, is our lover paying attention to us and how to get them back to us. We'll be right back.
Just another song, just another tale of a broken heart. Don't wanna see you hurt. There's something you should learn from the start. My friend, you ought to know. I'm afraid it's time to know. Whoever said love was easy.
Welcome back to Loved with Kim Sage on KX at One Laguna in amazing, awesome, wonderful. So grateful to live here in Laguna Beach. So today we're just talking about adult attachment and why we love the way we love and how we love the way we love. That really all of that comes from our initial quality of caregiving from the time we're little. And of course, it's impacted and plays out over our adult and child lifespan. But that the core of that is really developed in the early years. And so we were talking a little bit about the idea that, codependency in terms of relationships can be a bit of a myth, that we really are truly wired to connect to one another. And so that's what drives our behavior, and that we are rewarded when we do that biologically, emotionally, and evolutionary wise. So one of the things we were going to talk about when we came back is the idea of what we call protest behaviors. Now, really, the idea is that we're protesting something we don't like in the relationship because we really want to be back and connected again. But we're not getting that. And so we're doing things like, you know, calling our partner several times, acting crazy, trying to make our partner jealous, being distant on purpose in a way we kind of know they're going to read. And that we're really doing that because these are really protests over the idea that our emotional connection is somehow fractured. I always say this in therapy that the emotional connection, especially with couples, is number one. So who cares how great you can communicate if you aren't connected emotionally? You have to find the tools with communication, obviously, but you have to reconnect emotionally, or otherwise the relationship just doesn't feel safe. And so when people are protesting, that underneath that, they're really asking their partners sort of subconsciously, you know, can I count on you and depend on you? Are you going to be there for me? Will you respond when I need you? And, you know, do I matter to you? So then things like anger and criticism and these demands are really what we call their cries to our lovers. Sorry, you know, sort of trying to stir their hearts and to draw our mates back to us emotionally. So if you think about your next fight as a protest behavior, maybe it'll change the whole dynamic and you might not find yourself responding the same way. But really, there are some great ways of recognizing, you know, who you are in relationships. And certainly the book, as I've mentioned, Attached by Amir Levine, has lots of quizzes and those types of things. And that's just one small piece of the resources I have and use. But it is a foundation. And so People who are secure are going to be people who don't play games. They tend to reach compromises better. And, you know, they tend to introduce you to their friends and family earlier on. Now, I'm not talking about we went out on Friday night and you're meeting the family on Sunday. That might be a little too soon, but believe it or not, I've heard that one before. But really the idea that you're moving forward and that they are honest and open and authentic in their communication with you. People who are anxious are going to be more suspicious. They're always going to think you're cheating. They're going to be more likely to play games with you to get your attention. And they're going to let you set the tone of the relationship. And they often have a lot of insecurities and they're going to play out. And then people who are avoidant tend to have unrealistically romantic views of relationships. There's always something bigger and better. It could always be different. They tend to be more mistrustful. And during arguments, they often need to get away or they explode. You know, think about it. The emotion is literally too overwhelming for them. And they never really had the tools and experience from the way the brain is wiring at the beginning of their lives to understand that and to experience it in a more healthy and safe way. So they kind of need to bolt. And then the other really huge one I understand about avoidance and avoidant people in terms of relationships is this idea of mixed signals. This is the one that kind of makes you crazy because on the one hand, it seems like they're really into you and things are going forward and then something else happens and they're just taking a step back. But if you bring it up, they're like, no, you're crazy. I don't know what we're talking about. But you feel it in your gut. And there's oftentimes difficult to find words around it. But I always say, you know, trust your intuition, trust your gut about that. And really, the reality is that each style, the way it works is that the view of intimacy the person has, you know, and their view of togetherness based on these styles really impacts the way they deal with conflict, their attitudes towards sex, and their ability to communicate their wishes and needs, and certainly their expectations from their partner and from the relationship. And so I think the trick is that oftentimes we are auditioning in relationships, you know, we're putting our best foot forward and we're trying to be a different style at our core than we really are. And then, you know, what happens when time goes on? It's that thing where people say to me, well, I don't know, they weren't like this in the beginning, you know, or I could say the same thing. I've experienced it myself. And you wonder, you know, what's going on? The reality is for most people, as time wears on, those boundaries and those walls against intimacy are coming down or they're being brushed up against in some way and something's being triggered. So, you know, the hard thing is you wouldn't necessarily know how to recognize these things. You know, it's not like you'd go on a date and be saying, hey, you know what? I tend to get really clingy and angry when I feel abandoned. And by abandoned, I pretty much mean anytime you go anywhere without me. You know, I'm trying to imagine that on a first date. That would not go well. You know, don't bother me when I'm alone or I'll think you're too demanding. Like, who's going to say that in the beginning? And this is my favorite one. I'm going to constantly send you mixed signals about whether or not I'm into you. So I hope you love always being confused and doubting yourself and our relationship. I mean, those are silly, but that's just kind of what happens is, you know, you wonder what's going on. The styles are really in terms of the percentage of the population. They vary. Supposedly, the research says that, you know, 50% of us are secure, 20-ish percent anxious, 25 avoidant, and about a little less than 20, a combination. I actually think people are a combination. Many people are. And people always ask me when I ask for questions, you know, can I be a combination? Can one person make me one way and one another? And I do think you have a sort of baseline for who you are in terms of styles. But there's no doubt that certain people can trigger certain things in you. And so with one girlfriend or boyfriend, you could find yourself one way and then another one another way. And we can go way deeper into that in terms of why that occurs, but I don't have time for that. Nor do you probably want to hear any more about it in terms of the extensiveness of that. But it is fascinating how that happens. And so, you know, once you know all of this, then you can begin to understand that on some level, romantic behaviors are predetermined and reliable and predictable. And that learning your own style really helps you understand what your needs are, who you should be with to be happy. And if you already are in a relationship, it will help you and your partner really better understand and relate to one another. You know, you have to really know who you are before you can know who you want. The book talks about some great ways to go through figuring out, you know, what type you are and what type your partner is. And one of the things we've done in the groups before that I've run is had people do a timeline. So I would recommend you do it at the beginning or even just now, you know, make yourself a straight line from the first relationship to where you are now. And for every relationship you've had, you know, at least the ones that are somewhat significant, write down what were the reasons you broke up. What was the theme? What did you fight about? What were the main issues in the relationship? And I've almost never had someone do this and not find some pattern or some theme. You know, it was whether it's infidelity or they were never physically available. They're always working. You know, that could be avoidant. Try to figure out what those patterns are, because once you understand not only yourself, but what you're drawn to, it truly will help you, you know, change who you choose. And not only that, but it will help you recognize early on, you know what, I like this person and I really want to be in a relationship with them, but the odds are not good. And I'm better to get myself out now, because as we all know, you know, a few months in, I mean, it doesn't take long before we can get really attached. And detaching from our relationship, whether it's a short-term one and particularly, you know, longer ones, can truly be incredibly painful. Some of the questions I get from people are, you know, are these set in stone? No, they're not set in stone, but, you know, ideally you probably tend to be more one than the other. And like I said, you could have different types of attachment relationships based on who you're with. And so it's important to know that. It's the foundation of understanding who you are. And I've even seen it play out in terms of your work relationships and friendships. Once you know this about yourself, you can kind of understand, why am I being triggered? What, you know, this seems like no big deal. Why does like skipping a lunch date with me at work bother me? Oh, it's that thing where I have a hard time people not showing up for me. I mean, it can be that simple and yet that complicated. So I think it's incredibly fascinating. And really just to wrap up, the idea is, you know, so, okay, Kim, I get it. I'm this or that. Like, what do I do now? And of course I have a bias, you know, towards working on yourself and therapy, but certainly not everyone needs therapy. It's always up to you and what you need. Some of the ways you can do it, if you want, you know, alongside therapy and or instead of, you could do journaling. We know that journaling reduces can lower our blood pressure, and that it really helps us begin to make sense of our story in life. And so highly encourage you to journal and see if you can make some, you know, meaning out of what you've been through and why you choose who you choose. Techniques on self-reflection and mindfulness. Such a huge fan of meditation. I think you've probably mentioned it before. Love it. And it really changed my life when I was able to not just mindfully, you know, look at what I'm doing, really begin to be present with what was going on in my life and why I'm feeling what I'm feeling, and honor that. And, you know, there's different types of meditation. There's, you know, relaxation meditation. There's mindful awareness. This one would be two things. One, you could learn to do the relaxation one when you're feeling anxiety. And you could also learn to become mindfully aware of, oh, I'm doing that thing again, you know, and it can change your life and the people that you bring into your life or don't. And like I said, of course, I believe in therapy, but there's different ways to get there too. There's groups and individual, and there's so many amazing just things to read, you know, materials you can give yourself, quizzes and reflections and activities that will change who you choose and how you love and why you love. As we come to the close, I came across a quote that I thought was so powerful in terms of this area, because I think sometimes people kind of get overwhelmed when they think about, oh gosh, I had this kind of childhood, or how am I ever going to, you know, how's that going to affect the rest of my life? And it's a difficult subject for all of us on some level. I always say, I think all of us are trying to recover from some aspect of our childhood, some much more traumatic than others. But the quote is from Marianne Williamson, and it is that Healing doesn't mean the damage never occurred. It means the damage no longer controls our lives. And I think that that's just so profound. So that's really it for my little one-woman show today workshop. Thank you so much for listening to Love with Kim Sage today on KX at One Laguna. The show airs every Tuesday at 1, and so I hope you'll join me next week. I have an amazing guest coming. We're going to talk about the movie Still Alice with Julianne Moore, who is nominated for a Best Actress Oscar. As I've mentioned before, I'm doing my dissertation on using films in therapy. I've always had a passion for that. And so what I'd like to do is to break the films down psychologically. And we're going to talk about what it's like to, obviously, to live with the disease, but also to be a family member or caregiver with someone you love who's going through something like that. And just in terms of the entire film, we're going to break that down. So please join me for that. I'll probably do some more movie shows since the Oscars are coming up. And you can always listen to my podcast on kx.onelaguna.com. Just go to the shows page and click on Loved with Kim Sage. You can also contact me with any questions or topic requests on Twitter at K-Sage Psychology. That's K-S-A-G-E Psychology. Or you can visit my website at www.kimsage.com. If you have an amazing show idea or know someone you think would be a great guest, just to talk about topics around love and relationships with, you know, ourselves or others or our world. I'd love to have you let me know and contact me, and love to have you join the show. So really, that's it. Thanks again to everyone. I so appreciate your support. Have a beautiful day. And remember, everyone just wants to be seen, heard, and loved.
Just a boy caught up in dreams and fantasies. Please see me reaching out for someone I can't see. Take my hand, let's see where we wake up tomorrow. Best laid plans, sometimes it's just a one night stand. I'll be damn, Cupid's the man to back his arrow. So let's get drunk on our tears. And God, tell us the reason youth is wasted on the young. It's hunter season and the lambs are on the run, searching for meaning. But are we
smart talk shows from comedy to relationship advice. View our schedule at kx.onelaguna.com.